Osho, The Book of Wisdom, Volume 1. Discourses on Atisha's 7 Points of Mind Training. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 16.
The first question. Bhagwan. Yes and no. Premathu. Man is a dilemma. He is both yes and no. It is not abnormal with you. It is the normal state of humankind. Man is half earth, half sky, part matter, part consciousness, part dust, part divine. Man is a tension. Friedrich Nietzsche says a rope is stretched between two infinities. The past is that of animal, and the future is that of God. And between the two is man, half animal, half angel. The no comes from the past. The yes is a possibility for the future. Doubt comes from darkness. Trust is the byproduct of light. The higher self in you is always trusting. The lower is cunning and is always doubting. And you are both as you are now. Man naturally is schizophrenic. Schizophrenia is not a disease. It is not pathology. It is the state of normal human beings. It starts looking like a pathology only when it goes to the extreme. When yes and no are so divided that there is not even an end to bridge them. When they become unbridgeable, then it becomes pathological. Otherwise, every human being is always in a kind of duality, in a state of either or. No other animal is in that state. Dogs are simply dogs. And lions are lions. And trees are trees. And rocks are rocks. They don't have any duality. There is no division. Man is dual, double, divided. It is his misery, but it is also the possibility of his bliss. It is his agony, but out of this agony, ecstasy can be born. No animal can be ecstatic except man. Have you seen any animal ecstatic, ecstasy like Buddha, Ramakrishna? There is no possibility to come across an animal who is so ecstatic. Even the rose bush with so many beautiful flowers is not ecstatic in the sense Jesus is. The rose bush is simply a rose bush. There is no exuberance. There is no overflowing. There is no rejoicing. It is a matter of fact. Not that something incredible is happening. Not that something from the beyond has descended. Not that God has been realized. Not that light has come and penetrated to the deepest core of your being and you are full of it and you are enlightened. The bird on the wing is free but knows nothing about freedom. Only man, even though he may be imprisoned, knows about freedom. Hence the misery, the bondage on one hand and the vision of freedom on the other. The reality, the ugly reality and the tremendously luminous possibility. Man can be miserable as no other animal can ever be miserable. Have you seen any animal crying his heart out, weeping, committing suicide? Have you seen any animal laughing? A belly laughter that shakes the very foundations. No, all these things are possible only for man. Hence the grandeur of man. Hence his dignity. And hence his anxiety too. The anxiety is whether you are going to make it or not. Whether this time it is going to happen or not. The anxiety is a natural consequence of two diametrically opposite possibilities. One can fall into hell and one can rise into heaven. And man is just the ladder. And you move on this ladder like yo-yo. One moment you are in heaven, another moment you are in hell. One moment suddenly the sunlit peak, another moment the darkest valley that you have ever come across. One moment love, sharing, another moment anger, miserliness. One moment such an expanded heart that you can contain the whole world, and another moment you are so mean that you cannot imagine you had this possibility to be so mean. Man goes on moving between these two infinities continuously, like a pendulum. Prem Madhu, your question is significant because it is everybody's question. It is not a question. It is far more existential. It is a problem. No answer can help. Some solution has to be searched for. Now, there are two possibilities for the solution. Either fall back and be satisfied with your animalness. Be satisfied. That's what millions are trying to do. Drink, eat, sleep, and forget all about the greater challenges of life. Eat, drink, be merry, because tomorrow we shall be no more. That's what the materialist says. The materialist has accepted the lower self. He denies the higher self just in sheer defense. He does not deny it because he knows that it is not. No, he knows nothing about it. He denies it because if he does not deny, then that either or opens up again. Again one is a problem. Again something has to be done. Again the at-easeness is lost. Again the journey, the wandering, and the uncomfort and the inconvenience and the insecurity of the journey. It is better to say that the higher does not exist, that there is no God, that there has never been any God, that there is no soul, that there is nothing inner, that man has no interiority, that man is just what he is from the outside, that man is his behavior. There is no soul in him. From Pavlov to B.F. Skinner, this is what is being taught by the so-called scientific psychologists to the world. The behaviorists. That man is only a behavior. There is no one inside. Just as there is no one inside a machine. The machine is just a functional unity. It has no organic unity in it. It has no soul. You can dismantle it. You can rearrange it again. That's what scientists hope, that sooner or later they will be able to dismantle man and reassemble him. At least theoretically it seems possible for them. It is not possible. You cannot dismantle and reassemble man. Because there is something which is non-mechanical in man. And that non-mechanical is his glory. But it is better to deny it. It makes life easier. It makes life less anxious. It makes life less of a problem. You can go on living the shallow day-to-day life of so-called pleasures. Eat, drink, be merry. Those who decide for it are renouncing the opportunity Atisha is talking about. They are renouncing the opportunity to become gods. They are settling for something very low. They are settling for something very cheap. They are missing something very essential. Yes, you can be at ease with the lower self, with the doubting self. You can settle, but then there is no growth. And there will be no ecstasy, because there will be never any Buddha born in you. You will never come to know anything of Christ consciousness. You will remain in darkness. Of course, at ease. But what is the point of being at ease? Far more valuable is creative discontent. Far more valuable is the insecurity of the unknown. Far more valuable is a homeless wandering in search of the real home. Religion is for those who don't accept the lower as the end and all. I am not saying deny the lower, remember, because there are foolish people who go to the other extreme. The one stupid type of people deny the higher and say it is not and settle with the lower. The other stupid kind denies the lower, says there is no lower, there is only higher. One says God is illusion, the world is truth. The other says the world is illusion, God is truth. In my approach, both are being stupid. Because both are doing the same thing. Both want to be at ease. Both are denying the polar opposite. Both are denying the possibility of any inner tension. And remember, it is the inner tension that gives you aliveness. And the bigger the tension, far more alive you are. You know, you have experienced it. Everybody has experienced it more or less. The attraction of the opposite. Man is attracted to women and vice versa. Why? The negative pole of electricity is attracted towards the positive pole and vice versa. Why? Why the attraction for the opposite? Because in that very attraction, life arises. In that tension, how can you remain dead? In that very tension, you start pulsating. Those who settle and choose one against the other become stale, become dead. The materialist becomes superficial, and your so-called spiritualist also becomes phony. Your so-called materialist lives with shallow pleasures, and your so-called spiritualist lives in imagination, in fantasy. Both are missing life and its life-giving tensions. Man has to live both, and in such a way that neither is denied, and yet both become complementary to each other. Yes need not be against no. There is no necessity that the no should be against the yes. They can define each other. They can nourish each other. That's my whole effort here. I bring you a new dispensation that the earth and the sky have to be accepted together. Body and soul, the world and God have to be accepted together. Nothing is wrong in the lower. The lower has to become the base for the higher. The lower has to function as the foundation. If you deny it, you won't have any foundation. That's why religious countries, for example India, became poorer and poorer and poorer. They lost foundations and became very phony. How can you be true if you deny something which is so real all around you? If you say the world is illusion, Maya, how can you be true? You know it is not. Even the person who says that the world is Maya does not try to pass through the wall. He goes through the door. If both are Maya, illusion, what is the difference? Can you make any difference between two illusions? Is one a little less illusion and the other a little more? Even the person who says the world is illusion does not start eating stones. What is the difference between bread and stone then? Both are illusions. Both are dreams. But denying the world, you lose contact with the reality. That's what happened in the East, particularly in India. India became disoriented from reality. It lost roots in the earth. It became unearthly, a little ghostly. That's my experience of India. India is a ghost. It has lost its body, and nobody else is responsible for it. It could not gather courage to accept the polar opposites. It became poor, it became ugly, it became ill. India had chosen it so that it can be at ease with the higher. But the higher can exist only with the lower. One thing more of great importance to be remembered. The lower can exist without the higher, although it will remain unfulfilled. But it can exist. The higher cannot even exist without the lower. You cannot have a building, a temple, a church without the foundations. But you can have the foundations without making the temple. That is possible. Because the lower comes first and the higher comes later. Lower can come and the higher may not come. The east tried the higher without the lower, the temple without the foundations. Now such a temple can only be in your imagination. It cannot exist in reality. And it creates hypocrisy. The greatest hypocrisy possible in the world has happened in India. The hypocrisy is, we have to live in the lower because the lower is the real, and we have to deny it and we have to talk about the higher. And because the lower is denied, the higher cannot have any substance. It is dream stuff. So people are very much obsessed with money, but they talk of God. Obsessed with politics, power, and they talk of God. That remains just a talk. In the West, the opposite has happened. The lower was accepted for the same reason. Because if there is only one, you can relax. You can drop the creative discontent if there is only one. Hence the attraction for the one. It is attraction towards suicide. Think of a world where only men exist and no women. There will be no tension, certainly. There will be great brotherhood. Everybody will be gay. Literally gay. But life will lose something. Something of immense importance. There will be no tension. It will be like loose wires of a sitar. You cannot create music. You have to make them tight and tense. Only then you can strike music out of them. Only then the hidden can become manifest. Loose wires, loose strings of a sitar. How can you create music? They have to be tight, in a certain tension. Only great masters know how much tension is the right tension. And in the right tension, the greatest melody possible. I teach you the right tension between the lower and the higher, between the body and the soul, between the earth and heaven. A right tension with no antagonism. The lower has not to be denied for the higher, neither the higher has to be denied for the lower. They are together. They are two aspects of the same reality. They interpenetrate. So I don't say drop your doubt. I don't say drop your no. I say let your no become the tension for your yes. Let your no become the background for your yes. Let your no create the context in which the yes will be more meaningful. In contrast, only meaning arises. You write with white chalk on blackboard. Why? Because only in contrast, the white will show. It will be loud and clear. Let no become the blackboard. And yes, the white writing on it. Your trust should not be a blind trust. Your trust should be a trust who has eyes. Your trust should not be an impotent trust, a trust which is trust because you are impotent in saying no. Your trust should be alive, strong, vital. Your trust will be capable of saying no. Say yes and yet retain the capacity to say no. Then you will be surprised. Your yes has such sharpness, such brilliance, such intelligence. Then it is not blind. It has eyes to see. Use no as a foundation for yes. Use doubt as a manure for the rose bush. Use everything that God has given to you. Nothing, nothing at all has to be denied. All has to be absorbed. Because nothing is unessential, unimportant. Even though sometimes it looks unessential, unimportant. Even though sometimes it looks positively harmful, poisonous. But it has not to be denied. It has not to be thrown, because later on the way, as you will become wiser, you will repent if you throw something away. Because you will need it in some situation. There are moments when the poison is needed as medicine. There are moments of wisdom when just the touch of the wise man and the poison becomes nectar. I want you to become alchemists. This is an alchemical school, an university for inner alchemy. We are trying to change the baser metal into gold. So remember, I accept your no too. I love your no too. I accept all that you are. I accept all that you are not, even that too. You are accepted whatsoever you are, and you are accepted whatsoever you are not. You are accepted in totality. From my side, there is no question of denying anything, but of transforming. The second question, Bhagwan, what is the ego remaining unenlightened? Are we always functioning through the ego, or are there moments when we are free of it? Prem Parijat. Man has no center. Separate from the center of the whole, there is only one center in existence. The ancients used to call it Tao, Dhamma, God. Those words have become old now. You can call it truth. There is only one center of existence. There are not many centers. Otherwise, the universe will not be really an universe. It will become a multiverse. It is a unity, hence the universe. It has only one center. But this is a little to be meditated upon. That one center is my center, your center, everybody's center. That one center does not mean that you are centerless. That one center simply means that you don't have a separate center. Let us say it in different words. You can make on one center many concentric circles. Many circles. You can throw in a silent lake a pebble. One center arises by the fall of the pebble. And then many concentric circles, and they go on spreading to the farthest shore. Millions of concentric circles, but they all have one center. Each can claim this center as his own. And in a way, it is his center. But it is not only his own. The ego arises with the claim that the center is mine, separate. It is not your center, it is mine center. It is me. The idea of a separate center is the root of the ego. When the child is born, he comes without a center of his own. 9 months in the mother's womb, he functions with the mother's center as his center. He is not separate. Then he is born. Then it is utilitarian to think oneself as having a separate center. Otherwise, life will become very difficult, almost impossible. To survive and to struggle in the fight of life for survival, everybody needs a certain idea of who I am. And nobody has any idea. In fact, nobody can have any idea, ever. Because at the deepest core, you are a mystery. You can't have any idea of it. At the deepest core, you are not individual. You are universal. That's why if you ask the Buddha, who are you? He remains silent. He does not answer it. He cannot. Because now he is no more separate. He is the whole. But in ordinary life, even Buddha has to use the word I. If he feels thirsty, he has to say that I am thirsty. Ananda, bring me a little water. I am thirsty. To be exactly true, he should say, Ananda, bring some water. The universal center is a little thirsty. But that will look a little odd. And to say it again and again, sometimes the universal center is hungry, and sometimes the universal center is feeling a little cold, and sometimes the universal center is tired. It will be unnecessary, absolutely unnecessary. So he continues to use the old meaningful word, I. It is very meaningful, though a fiction, but meaningful. But many fictions are meaningful. For example, you have a name, that is a fiction. You had come without a name. You had not brought a name with you. The name has been given to you. Then by a constant repetition, you start becoming identified with it. You know your name is Rama, or Rahim, or Krishna. It goes so deep that if you all 3,000 sannyasins fall asleep here and somebody comes and calls, Rama, where are you? Nobody will hear except Rama. Rama will say, who has come to disturb my sleep? Even in his sleep, he knows his name. It has reached to the unconscious. It has seeped through and through. But it is a fiction. But when I say it is a fiction, I don't mean it is unnecessary. It is necessary fiction. It is useful. Otherwise, how you are going to address? If you want to write a letter to somebody, whom you are going to write? A small child once wrote a letter to God. His mother was ill, and the father had died, and they had no money. So he asked God for 50 rupees. When the letter reached to the post office, they were at a loss what to do with it. Where to send it? It was simply addressed to God. So they opened it. They felt very sorry for the little boy. And they decided to collect some money and send to the boy. They collected some money. He had asked for 50 rupees, but they could collect only 40. The next letter came, again addressed to God, and the boy has written, Dear sir, please next time when you send the money, send it directly to me. Don't send it through the post office. They have taken their commission, 10 rupees. It will be difficult if nobody has a name. Although nobody has a name in reality, but it is a beautiful fiction, helpful. And nobody knows it more, because I don't think anybody in the whole history of humanity has given so many names as I have given. You can count on me. Names are needed for others to call you. I is needed for yourself to call you. But it is just a fiction. If you go deep into yourself, you will find the name has disappeared. The idea of I has disappeared. There is left only a pure amness, isness, existence, being. And that being is not separate. It is not yours and mine. That being is the being of all. Rocks, rivers, mountains, trees, all are included. It is all inclusive. It excludes nothing. The whole past, the whole future, this immense universe, everything is included in it. The deeper you go into yourself, the more and more you will find that persons don't exist, then individuals don't exist, then what exists is a pure universalness. On the circumference we have names, egos, identities. When we jump from the circumference towards the center, all those identities disappear. The ego is just a useful fiction. Use it, but don't be deceived by it. Parijat, you also ask, remaining unenlightened, are we always functioning through the ego? Or are there moments when we are free of it? Because it is a fiction, there are moments when you are free of it. Because it is a fiction, it can remain there only if you go on maintaining it. A fiction needs great maintenance. Truth needs no maintenance. That is the beauty of truth. But a fiction, you have constantly to paint it, give it a prop here and there, and it is constantly collapsing. By the time you have managed one side, the other side starts collapsing. And that's what people go on doing their whole life. Trying to manage the fiction as if it is the truth. Have more money, then you can have a bigger ego. A little more solid than the ego of the poor man. The poor man's ego is thin. He can't afford a thicker ego. Become the prime minister or a president of a country, and your ego is puffed to the extremes. Then you don't walk on the earth. Our whole life, the search for money, power, prestige, this and that, is nothing but search for new props, search for new supports, to keep the fiction somehow going. And all the time you know death is coming, and whatsoever you make, death is going to destroy it. But still, one goes on hoping against hope. Maybe everybody else dies, but not you. And in a way it is true. You have always seen other people dying. You have never seen yourself dying. So it seems true also, logical also. This person dies, that person dies, and you are always there to feel sorry for them. And you never die. and you always go with them to the cemetery to say goodbye, and you are back again home. Don't be deceived by it, because all those people were doing the same thing, and nobody is an exception. Death comes and destroys the whole fiction of your name, fame. Death comes and simply effaces all. Not even footprints are left. Whatsoever we go on making out of our life is nothing but writing in waters, not even on sand, but on waters. You have not even written it, and it is gone. You cannot even read it. Before you could have read, it is gone. But we go on trying to make these castles in the air. Because it is a fiction, it needs constant maintenance, constant effort, day and night. And nobody can be so careful 24 hours. So sometimes, in spite of you, there are moments when you have a look of reality without the ego functioning as a barrier, without the screen of the ego. There are moments. In spite of you, remember, everybody once in a while has moments. For example, every night when you fall deep in sleep, and the sleep is so deep that you cannot even dream, then the ego is no more found. All the fictions gone. Deep, dreamless sleep is a kind of small death. In dream, there is a possibility. You may manage. People go on managing their ego even in their dreams. That's why psychoanalysis tries to go deep into your dreams, because there is less possibility of you maintaining your identity. More loopholes can be found there. In the daytime, you are very alert and on guard, continuously with a shield to protect your ego. In dream, sometimes you forget. But the people who have been studying dream, they say, even in dream, the protection remains, it becomes a little subtle. For example, you see a dream that you have killed your uncle. If you go deep into it, you will be surprised. You wanted to kill your father, but you killed your uncle. You deceived. The ego played a game. You are such a good guy. How can you kill your own father? And the uncle looks like father. Although nobody wants to kill one's uncle, uncles are always nice people. Who wants to kill one's uncle? And who does not want to kill one's own father? There is bound to be great antagonism between the father and the son. The father has to discipline the son. He has to curb and cut and order and force him to obey And nobody wants to obey and to be disciplined and shoulds and should nots. And the father is so powerful that the son feels jealous. And the greatest jealousy is that the son wants the mother to be completely his own. And this father completely always comes in between. He is always there. The son feels jealous of the father. Not only that, the father also feels jealous of the son. Because he is always there between his wife and him. Mulla Nasruddin's son got married. Mulla Nasruddin came with his wife home, with the friends, relatives, the whole house was full. He went for something out, and when he came in, he was very much taken aback. His father was hugging his wife and kissing her. This was too much. This is not allowed. He was very angry and said, "What are you doing?" And the father said, "And what you have been doing your whole life? You have been kissing and hugging my wife. And I never said anything to you." He may not have said, but he must have felt. There is an antagonism between the father and the son, between the daughter and the mother. A natural antagonism, a natural jealousy. The daughter wants to possess the father, but the mother is there. She looks like the enemy. But uncles are very beautiful people. But in a dream, you will not kill your own father. Your moral conscience, part of your ego, will prevent you doing such a thing. You will find a substitute. This is a strategy. If you minutely observe your dreams, you will find many strategies the ego is still trying to play. The ego cannot accept the fact that I am killing my own father. I am such an obedient son, respectful towards the father, so much loving, and trying to kill my father. The ego won't accept the idea. The ego sifts the idea a little bit to the side. The uncle looks almost like the father. Kill the uncle. That seems easier. The uncle is only a substitute. This is what goes on even in dreams. But in dreamless sleep, the ego completely disappears. Because when there is no thinking, no dreaming, how can you carry a fiction? But dreamless sleep is very small. In 8 hours healthy sleep, not more than 2 hours. But only those 2 hours are revitalizing. If you had 2 hours deep dreamless sleep in the morning, you are new, fresh, alive. Life has again a thrill to it. The day seems to be a gift. Everything seems to be new because you are new. And everything seems to be beautiful because you are in a beautiful space. What happened in these 2 hours when you fell in the deep sleep? What Patanjali calls susupti, dreamless sleep, the ego disappears. And the disappearance of the ego has revitalized you, rejuvenated you. The disappearance of the ego, even though in deep unconsciousness, but you had a taste of God. Patanjali says there is not much difference between susupti, dreamless sleep, and samadhi, the ultimate state of Buddhahood. Not much difference, although there is a difference. The difference is that of consciousness. In dreamless sleep, you are unconscious. In samadhi, you are conscious. But the state is the same. You move in God. You move into the universal center. You disappear from the circumference and you go to the center. Just that contact with the center. And it so rejuvenates you. The people who cannot sleep are really miserable people, very miserable people. They have lost a natural source of being in contact with God. They have lost a natural passage into the universal. A door has closed. This century is the first century which is suffering from sleeplessness. We have closed all other doors. Now the last door we are closing, the door of sleep. That seems to be the last disconnection with the universal energy. The greatest danger. And now there are foolish people in the world who are writing books and with very logical acumen that sleep is not needed at all. It is a wastage of time. They are right. It is a wastage of time. People who think in terms of money, work, the people who are workaholics, for them it is a wastage of time. Just that as there is now Alcoholics Anonymous, soon we will need Workaholics Anonymous. I propose Morarji Desai's names for the president of Workaholics Anonymous. People who are obsessed with work, they have to be constantly on the go. They cannot rest, they cannot relax. Even when they are dying, they will be doing something or other. These people are now suggesting that sleep is unnecessary. They are suggesting that sleep is really an unnecessary hangover from the past. They say that in the past, when there was no electricity and no fire, out of necessity people had to sleep. Now there is no need. It is just an old habit, imbibed in millions of years. It has to be dropped. Their idea is that in future, sleep will disappear. And the same is happening behind the iron curtain in Rasa too. They are creating new devices so that people can be taught things while they are asleep. a new kind of education. So time is not wasted. The last torture that we are going to invent for the children. We invented the school. We are not satisfied with that. Small children imprisoned in schools. In India, schools and the prisons used to be painted the same way, the same color, the same type of buildings. Ugly, with no aesthetic sense, with no trees and birds and animals around them, so that children are not distracted. Otherwise, who will listen to the foolish mathematics teacher when a cuckoo suddenly starts calling by the window? Or a deer comes into the class and the teacher is teaching you geography or history. The children will be distracted, so they have to be taken away from nature, away from society. They have to be forced to sit on hard benches for 6 hours, 5 hours, 7 hours. This goes on for years together. Almost one third of the life is spent in schools. You have made slaves. In their remaining life also they will remain workaholics. They will not be able to have a real holiday. Now, they are thinking, why waste night time? So children can be put for night education. They will be asleep on the bed, but their ears will be connected to a central school. And in a very, very subtle, subliminal way, messages will be put into their head, they will be programmed. And it has been found that they can learn easily in this way than they learn while they are awake. Naturally, because when you are awake, howsoever you are protected, thousand and one things distract your mind. And children are so full of energy, everything attracts them. They are continuously distracted. That is just energy, nothing else. There is no sin in it. They are not dead, that's why they are distracted. A dog starts barking. Somebody starts fighting outside. Somebody plays a trick on the teacher. Or somebody says a joke. And there are thousand and one things which go on distracting. But when a child is asleep, and deep asleep, when the dreams are not there, there is no distraction at all. Now that dreamless sleep can be used as part of pedagogy. It seems we are in every way ready to disconnect ourselves with the universal source of being. Now these children will be the ugliest possible. Because even when there was a possibility to be lost completely beyond the ego, that has also been taken away. The last possibility of ego disappearance is no more available then. When they could have been in contact with God, they will be taught some rubbish history. The dates when Genghis Khan was born. Who bothers? Who cares? In fact, if Genghis Khan was never born, that would have been far better. That's what I had written in my paper, and my teacher was very angry. I had to stand for 24 hours outside the class because I had written it is unfortunate that he was born. It would have been very, very fortunate if he was not born. But kings and emperors, they go on and on being born just to torture small children. They have to remember the dates and the names for no reason at all. A better kind of education will drop all this crap. 90% is crap. And the 10% can be very much improved. And life can have more joy, more rest, more relaxation. Because the ego is a fiction, it disappears sometimes. The greatest time is dreamless sleep. So make it a point that sleep is very valuable. Don't miss it for no other reason. Make sleep slowly, slowly a regular thing, because body is a mechanism. If you follow a regular pattern of sleep, the body will find it easier and the mind will find it easier to disappear. Go to the bed exactly the same time. Don't take it literally. If one day you are late, you will not be sent to hell or anything. Because there are people, that's why I have to be cautious. There are few people here, health freaks. Their only disease is that they are continuously thinking of health. If they stop thinking of health, they will be perfectly well. But if you can make your sleep a regular thing, almost the same time going to bed and almost the same time coming out, the body is a mechanism, the mind too. And then it simply slips into dreamless sleep at a certain moment. The second greatest source of egoless experiences is sex, love. That too has been destroyed by the priests. They have condemned it, so it is no more such a great experience. Such a condemnation for so long, it has conditioned the mind of people. Even while they are making love, they know deep down that they are doing something wrong. Some guilt is lurking somewhere. And this is so even for the most modern, the most contemporary, even the younger generation. On the surface, you may have revolted against the society. On the surface, you may no more be a conformist. But things have gone very deep. It is not a question of revolting on the surface. You can grow long hairs that won't help much. You can become a hippie and stop taking baths. That won't help much. You can become a dropout in every possible way that you can imagine and think, but that won't help really, because things have gone too deep, and all these are superficial measures for thousands of years. We have been told that sex is the greatest sin. It has become part of our blood, bone, marrow. So even if you know consciously there is nothing wrong in it, the unconscious keeps you. A little detached, afraid, guilt-ridden, and you cannot move into it totally. If you can move into love-making totally, ego disappears. Because at the highest peak, at the highest climax of love-making, you are pure energy. The mind cannot function with such joy, with such outburst of energy, the mind simply stops. It is such an upsurge of energy that the mind is at a loss. It does not know what to do now. It is perfectly capable of remaining in function in normal situations. But when anything very new and very vital happens, it stops. And sex is the most vital thing. If you can go deep into lovemaking, ego disappears. That is the beauty of lovemaking. That is another source of a glimpse of God. Just like deep sleep, but far more valuable than deep sleep, because in deep sleep you will be unconscious. In love making you will be conscious. Conscious yet without mind. Hence the great science of Tantra became possible. Patanjali and yoga worked on the lines of deep sleep. They had chosen that path. How to transform deep sleep into a conscious state so you know who you are, so you know what you are at the center. Tantra has chosen love making as a window towards God. The path of yoga is very long, because to transform unconscious sleep into consciousness is very arduous. It may take many lives. And who knows, you may be able to persist so long or not. Persever so long or not, be patient so long or not. So the fate that has fallen on yoga is this, that the so-called yogis go on only doing body postures. They never go deeper than that. That takes their whole life. Of course, they get better health, longer life. But that is not the point. You can have better health by jogging, running, swimming. You can have longer life by medical care. That is not the point. The point was how to become conscious in deep sleep. And your so-called yogis go on teaching people how to stand on your head and how to distort and contort your body. Yoga has become a kind of circus. Meaningless. It has lost its real dimension. In the new commune, I have the vision to revive yoga again in its true flavor, in its true dimension. And the goal is how to become conscious while you are deep asleep. That is the essential thing in yoga. And if any yogi is teaching anything else, it is all useless. But Tantra has chosen a far shorter way, the shortest, and far more pleasant too. Love making can open the window. All that is needed is to uproot conditionings that the priests have put into you. The priests have put those conditions into you so that they can become mediators and agents between you and God. So your direct contact is cut. Naturally, you will need somebody else to connect you, and the priest will become powerful. Priest has been powerful down the ages. Whosoever can put you in contact with power, real power, will become powerful. God is real power, the source of all power. The priest had remained down the ages so powerful, more powerful than the kings. Now the scientist has taken the place of the priest, because now he knows how to unlock the doors of power hidden in nature. The priest knew how to connect you with the God. The scientist knows how to connect you with nature. But the priest has to disconnect you first, so no individual private line remains between you and God. He has spoiled your inner sources, poisoned them. He became very powerful, but the whole humanity became lustless, loveless, full of guilt. My people have to drop that guilt completely. While making love, think of prayers, meditation. God, while making love, burn incense, chant, sing, dance. Your bedroom should be a temple, a sacred place. And love making should not be a hurried thing. Go deeper into it, savor it as slowly, as gracefully as possible. And you will be surprised. You have the key. God has not sent you in the world without keys. But those keys have to be used. You have to put them in the lock and turn them. Love is another one of the most potential phenomena. When ego disappears and you are conscious, fully conscious, pulsating, vibrating, you are no more an individual. You are lost into the energy of the whole. Then slowly, slowly let this become your very way of life. What happens at the peak of love has to become your discipline. Not just an experience, but a discipline. Then whatsoever you are doing and wherever you are walking, early in the morning with the sun rising, have the same feel, the same merger with existence. Lying down on the ground and the sky full of stars, have the same merger again. Lying down on the earth, feel one with the earth. Slowly, slowly, love making should give you the clue how to be in love with existence itself. And then the ego is known as a fiction, is used as a fiction. And to use it as a fiction, there is no danger. There are few other moments when the ego slips on its own accord. In moments of great danger, you are driving and suddenly you see the accident is going to happen. You have lost control on the car. And there seems to be no possibility to save yourself. You are going to crash into the tree or in the coming truck, or you are going to fall into the river. It is so absolutely certain. In those moments, suddenly ego will disappear. That's why there is a great attraction to move into dangerous situations. People climb the Everest. It is a deep meditation. They may understand, they may not understand. Mountaineering is of great importance. Climbing the mountains is dangerous. The more dangerous it is, the more beautiful. You will have glimpses. Great glimpses of egolessness. Whenever the danger will be very close, the mind stops. Mind can think only when you are not in danger. It has nothing to say about the danger. The danger makes you spontaneous, and in that spontaneity, you suddenly know that you are not the ego. Or these will be for different people, because people are different. If you have an aesthetic heart, then beauty will open the doors. Just seeing a beautiful woman or a man passing by, just for a single moment, a flash of beauty, and suddenly the ego disappears. You are overwhelmed. Are seeing a lotus in the pond, are seeing the sunset, are the bird on the wing, are anything that triggers your inner sensitivity, anything that possesses you for the moment so deeply that you forget yourself, that you are and yet you are not, that you abandon yourself. Then too, ego slips. It is a fiction. You have to carry it. If you forget it for a moment, it slips. And it is good that there are few moments when it slips by, and you have the glimpse of the true and the real. It is because of these glimpses that religion has not died. It is not because of the priests. They have done everything to kill it. It is not because of the so-called religious, those who go to the church and the mosque and the temple. They are not religious at all. They are pretenders. Religion has not died because of these few moments which happen to almost everybody, more or less. Take more note of them. Imbibe the spirit of those moments more. Allow those moments more. Create spaces for those moments to happen more. And this is the true way to see God. Not to be in the ego is to be in God. The third question. Bhagwan, why do you emphasize the importance of here now so much? Rahim, because there is nothing else. Here is the only space now, the only time. Beyond the here now, there is nothing. Two thousand years ago, a great Jewish master, Hillel, wrote a little poem in Aramaic. The poem is this: if I am not for myself, then who can be for me? And if I am only for myself, then what am I? And if not now, when? It is a beautiful statement. If not now, then when? Tomorrow? But the tomorrow never comes. Hence I emphasize the here now. Don't let this moment slip by unused, unlived, unpenetrated. Excuse all that you can out of this. Live it with intensity and passionately. So you need not repent later on that you missed your life. It was after the Second World War. The war had ended. Joe Dink was still in Japan, waiting to be discharged. His wife, Irma Dink, was wild with anxiety and jealousy because she read about the goings on between the American soldiers and the Japanese girls. Finally, she could stand it no longer, and she wrote her husband, Joe, "Hurry up and come back. What do those girls have anyway that the American girls don't?" "Not a thing," wrote back Joe, "but what they have got here." And that is the most important thing. The question is of here and now. And the last question. Bhagwan, what is a miracle? Sadananda, it depends. To me, everything is a miracle. I never come across anything that is not a miracle. Only miracles exist. Everything is such a surprise. So unbelievably it is. But if your eyes are closed, if your eyes are full of dust, if your mind is too much knowledgeable, if you think you know all, then nothing is a miracle. To know that I don't know anything makes everything a miracle. It depends on your inner state. It depends on you. And to live a life without miracles is not to live at all. You can have million miracles every day. You are entitled to have them. But because you don't know how to connect yourself with the miraculous, you are being cheated by stupid people. Then somebody produces a Swiss-made watch and you think this is a miracle. Then you become victims of ordinary magicians. Don't be befooled. The seed is sprouting into leaves is a miracle. not somebody producing out of nothing a Swiss made watch. That is just a trick, a very ordinary trick. Street magicians are doing it all over the world. Just they are simple people. They are not cunning people. Otherwise, you would have worshipped them. While exploring the wilds of South America, a man was captured by savages. They were dancing excitedly around before killing him, when the explorer had a bright idea. He would baffle them with magic. Taking a cigarette lighter from his pocket, he shouted, "I make fire." With a flick of the thumb, the lighter burst into flame. The savages fell back and gazed in wonder. "Magic!" cried the explorer. "It certainly is," said the chief. "It is the only time I ever saw a lighter work on the first try." It depends on you. What you call miracle, as far as I am concerned, there is nothing else than miracles. And drop these stupid kind of miracles. Mulla Nasruddin and his wife were sitting one Sunday listening to the radio when this faith healer came on and he says, "If you have a part of your body you want healed, place one hand on the radio and the other hand on the afflicted part." The wife placed one hand on the radio and the other on her heart. The mullah placed one hand on the radio and the other on his appendage. So the wife said, "Mullah, he is trying to cure the sick, not raise the dead." Enough for today.